Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
All right, folks, welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're back into some content. We took a little break with Friday and Monday, so we're diving back into the Constitution. It's still Constitution Week, technically. And with this show, because we're committed to going through the entire Constitution, kind of having these conversations regarding what these things mean, then, you know, obviously it requires a little bit of help. And actually, I want to cover content with assistance, because bottom line, as I read things, it's just mundane and, you know, boring to me. And so I figured, well, why don't I basically, you know, misery loves company. That's a principle and a rule. And so it's really important that I share that misery. And that's why we have Tammy back with us. So welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
Always have to come up with a new way of doing it. But and don't forget that debt is fraud. So we've been covering the enumerated powers. I can't stress enough, folks, that when they talk about the delegated powers, what they're meaning is Article 1, Section 8. This is where they literally list the powers. Now, they also identify specific powers, like we will cover in Article 3, that the Supreme Court will have the power as the judiciary to basically rule or create rulings or hearing cases and determining whether those cases are, and obviously we'll get into the jurisdiction and all of that, but they have the power to determine whether the Constitution is being violated or not. They do not have the power to create law. We already covered that the only agency right here in Article 1, the only entity that has the power to create law is the Congress. The only entity that has the power to negate law is the president. And we'll get into that in Article 2. So when it comes to law, the president can't make law. The judiciary can't make law. Only our representatives. This is why when we cover the ratification debates, we really spell out why your representatives are the sovereigns. They're the most powerful part of our government, not the judiciary. And somehow, and actually it's not somehow, because with Tammy, we actually exposed how the judiciary elevated itself because of Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And I think that Hamilton knew that the Bar Association would slowly be, you know, penetrate America into, they'll permeate themselves into our common law and they will take over. That was another part of the design of how we were going to basically be co-opted by the British controls. Now, what's really interesting, and I'm going to go down a conspiracy, you know, path real quick, that I don't think it was well understood how the crown would actually, and how the crowns of the earth were going to be co-opted. There was a book written by John Robison, and it's on my website. It's called, and I mention this a lot, The Conspiracy to Overthrow the Governments and Religions of Europe. Technically, he was a little short-sighted because the intention was to overthrow the governments and religions of the world with this global communism. This was the exposure. This was written in 1790s. So, you know, the framers didn't really see this, but they, you know, the reality is that as this plan was moving forward, the question is, well, did they ever? Because nobody ever saw the changing of the guard when it came to the king. How did this happen? And when you really start peeling the onion, if you really want to go down this path of understanding how this mess got created, then it can consume you. That's why I tell people, don't worry about how we got here. What's important is that we actually have a system, a government, and the supreme law of the land that was actually instilled and created as our foundational government this Constitution, and we have a way of actually restoring. In other words, it's kind of like, you know, you're walking along, the Constitution existed, they created this body, and then over time it kind of rained and dusty and so forth, and over time things started collecting over this body to where it got encrusted, to where the body all of a sudden couldn't move. This person, this entity, the Constitution, became so constrained because it was engulfed in, you know, the erosion and the accumulation of dust. You see my point of how it kind of created this cocoon, and it just basically got locked in with all this illegitimacy. There was no legitimacy done in creating the corporations, all of these things. And so I'm going down this path because this has been the bane that I've been facing over the past few years. And I mean that because it is literally the problem that I have to deal with, because I deal with good patriots that really believe that all these things are legitimate. Oh, look, they created this corporate. They didn't create the corporation with the authority that it was within the Constitution. The public servants literally violated their oath, just like when they created the bank. That was a violation. Just because they did it and the states didn't stop them doesn't make it legitimate. And Madison spells this out in 1817 when Congress wanted to create the Department of Transportation. And he says, even if the states let you do this without amending the Constitution, it's still not legitimate.
Right.
And so he says, we have to follow the process. And for whatever reason, I think this goes back down to the divine hand of providence, that there was this convincing of these nefarious or pernicious people that were serving in government, that they just refused to do it the right way. They were going to continually violate and create this crust around the Constitution, so thick and so hard people don't even recognize, and they just say, you know, our government is wrong and it's illegitimate. Well, 99% of it, but when you get to the core, or maybe less than that, but not when you get to the core of the government, it is still legitimate. That core part, the Constitution, is still legitimate. The original Constitution. When people say, oh, look at the Constitution they have today, the annotated Constitution. So this becomes this quagmire that I keep on fighting, and it's hard for me to get out of. Because people keep on saying, well, this is all, you know, these corporations, they're doing this, these powers and so forth. And I say that, yeah, that's illegitimate. And I feel like I just repeat myself. And it's not because of stress. there's an old line. It's a part of a song. I repeat myself when I'm under stress. I repeat myself when I'm under stress. And you that just keep on saying that. I have to do this because every time somebody, you know, throws out, well, you know, what they did is they redefined the people and they made us chattel and they made us slaves and they did all of these things. So now we're slaves. And I go, the illegitimate government is defined us as slaves. That doesn't define you. I mean, it's kind of like me telling you that you're now a child of Satan because you're no longer a child of God because Satan rules this world in governments. Well, no. You are a child of God, and you'll always be a child of God. And that Constitution was created by the divine hand of providence in such a way that they cannot actually form, or I should say, change it into some legitimate thing of Satan. Does that make sense?
I mean, that's a really good analogy. Yeah.
Okay, so just because they did all of these things that completely subvert the intent and have perverted our government, it does not make all of these illegitimate things legitimate.
Right.
We have to constantly, I have to always repeat myself, that is not legitimate. People talk all ill type of things regarding the 14th Amendment. Oh, the 14th Amendment is the source of the problem. And I tell them, no, actually, it's not. It may have been a catalyst that required the British Empire to respond, because America, after they got duped. Britain was duped because they literally bought into the superiority of the Confederation because they were superior. When we look at the warfare, the tactics, the Union was going to lose because the Union didn't have the noble cause for what they were fighting for. It was Lincoln saying, you can't leave, you can't leave. There was no constitutionality of anything that Lincoln did. You can't look at Lincoln as a great man. He was a tyrant. But he served a purpose, because we came to a point as a nation where the stress level of slavery, because the design was actually to out-evolve or evolve slavery out of America by the Constitution. You're probably not privy to this, or you've probably never heard me rant on this, but the design of the Constitution was of such that slavery would become obsolete. Most people didn't even recognize this, but actually in the ratification debates, it was brought up in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. And so they recognized that, if you really look at this, over time, the Union, or I should say the Northern states and the abolition movement, will overcome the Southern states just by the nature of how those states were going to move forward. Because when you have, South Carolina, North Carolina, you have a few states, Georgia, that are entrenched, because during the Constitutional Convention, Virginia was an advocate for actually getting rid of slavery.
So where can one find true history about Lincoln?
I will tell you that there's a lot of artifacts out there that you can read. I try to get people to say, read source documents. If you read anything that's editorializing, like when I write, I really try to write at an academic level, where I know that my biases guide my pen. But what I do is I basically, when I'm throwing out my editorials, I actually say, this is based on this information. Read this. Tell me I'm wrong. And so I kind of lay it out there in that manner. There's not a lot of people that write that way. There's not a lot of people that write, quote unquote, academically. Yeah. Now, there are some people that do that. But I mean, and some of the documents that I've read are, Kurt Lash. He wrote a 3-part thesis on the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, back to Lincoln, and to answer your question, I think it's De Lorenza is one that kind of wrote one, and they're out there, and I can give you those, but you're better off trying to actually read the things that Lincoln really did. And then you can start understanding that when he dismissed Congress, what ended up happening is 4 states ended up seceding from the Union. And before more states in the South could secede, Lincoln basically says, you're not, I'm dismissing all of you. Because when a secession occurs, the senators and representatives of that state get up and walk out. I mean, they literally leave their post in the representation of the government. And that's what happened. And basically, the Southern states were forming this confederation. And as Lincoln saw this happening, he said, well, I'm not going to let you leave. I'm dismissing everybody and taking over. And he appointed himself as king and president. And he started executing all sorts of things that he had no authority to do. And I try to tell people, all of this, Lincoln had no authority to do it. The Constitution did not empower him to suspend habeas corpus. Only Congress could do that. But he did it. Lincoln did all sorts of things he shouldn't have done. And see, the real problem is people start really waking up to, who Lincoln really was, and they look at the Republican Party, who basically has put him on a pedestal.
Oh, an absolute pedestal.
And And actually, even the African Americans put him on a pedestal because they thought he was, you know, the hero that ended slavery. No. The divine hand of providence, our creator, is the hero. And as a matter of fact, he used Lincoln as a tool, and it was a very harsh tool. If, and forgive me because we're supposed to be covering the Constitution, but if you go into Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, and actually I think I brought those up last night. Actually, I do have them right here. Just by providence, I happen to have these. And if I go to August 22nd, in the notes on the convention, this is when George Mason, I'm sorry, my voice kind of probably went faded a little bit, but this is when George Mason, right here, yep, this is when George Mason basically made his, this was a moment in time where he basically predicted that this nation and these states would be basically under God's judgment and will suffer. And this is where he says this. This is the famous statement of George Mason. Every master of slaves is born a petty tyrant. They bring the judgment of heaven on a country. As nations cannot be rewarded or punished in the next world, they must be in this. By an inevitable chain of causes and effects, Providence punishes nations' sins by national calamities. He lamented that some of our Eastern brethren, this is a little editorial by Madison, basically saying that he did this. He says, he lamented that our Eastern brethren had, from a lust of gain, embarked in this nefarious traffic. As to the states being in possession of the right of import, this was the case of many rights now to properly be given up. And then he held it an essential point that the general government should have the power to prevent the increase of slavery. And so what they did was they basically said, you can import slaves for 20 years. There was this, he said this in response to the fact that they were making concessions in allowing slavery to continue. Again, Georgia was against it. There were only three states that kind of stood up and said, if you guys make us get rid of slavery, we can't be a part of the Union. Now, I really didn't want to, you know, necessarily focus on this, but I think, you know, to create a little closure, when you look at the three-fifths rule, when you look at the fact that they stopped the importation in 1808, what we see is a realization by the states after the War of 1812 that slavery has been diminishing, that because all of the northern states have abandoned it, and states that were joining the Union were refusing to establish a slave state. Missouri was just in the sights in 1820. They were just a couple of years away from actually becoming a slave state. The history, the reality, the very first franchise in America were family slave plantations. So these large families started, or these families created these large plantations in Georgia and the Carolinas, and they became very affluent, more specifically in the Carolinas and in Virginia too. But over time, as they started moving westward, what ended up happening is the parents, you know, of these, because they had large families back then, they had to have lots of kids. And, you know, just to do the family business. And because of the high infant mortality rate, they didn't know if those kids were going to survive or not. So they had to have lots of kids. And so the parents that had these large plantations would give that plantation to their oldest child or whoever was the most, you know, blessed or the one they favored. And what they ended up doing was they would buy a large parcel of land and allocate resources for their other child westward to set up their next plantation. And so this became this long family business that started stretching across America. And there were several families, and technically there were 900 families that, you know, in 1861 or whatever, there was this conference, I think it was in South Carolina, where they kind of convened into a convention, And these 900 plus families, and I think Thomas Sowell kind of report, maybe it wasn't Sowell, it might have been either Woods or Gutzman, a historian basically identified that there was this small group of families that kind of pulled together. It wasn't 900 independent families. They were all probably cousins or what have you. But they were the ones that said, we are going to secede from the Union because we see the inevitable that they're going to make us get rid of slavery. And so that's why they seceded. But the reason what it would have happened a lot sooner had Congress not violated the Constitution by making the Missouri Compromise. Because the federal government, nowhere in the Constitution could the federal government actually allow, it was the destiny of the state to determine what they would be. And then all of a sudden, the Missouri Compromise of 1820 forced all states that joined the Union on a southern latitude, you know, the Mason-Dixon line, if you were a state that was south of that, you had to be a slave state.
Hmm.
And so what that did was that actually put wind in slavery, in the sails of slavery in America. In other words,
isn't it true, too, that Lincoln, I can't remember the quote exactly, but he basically said he didn't care with slavery continued or ended.
Yes, that was it was in the Douglas debates. Lincoln basically made some very disparaging remarks towards the slaves at the time. He said that they're incapable of ever being equal in mentality, capabilities, and so forth as whites. I mean, it was just really, you know, you could just see the ignorance of the man as what he was saying. And it was during that Lincoln-Douglas debates. And what's interesting, he was the one that went there. But the blacks today are African-Americans or, you know, whatever. Those people of the heritage in America of slavery, they look at the Lincoln-Douglas debates as, oh, this is just so, this makes us feel so good because it was something from Lincoln. But they never read it. They never really saw how, you know, Lincoln was just, he did not have a good opinion of blacks at all. And it was actually wrong. And it was absolutely very biased because it was Thomas Jefferson actually had a contrary view. He actually had that same view until he started meeting mathematicians and poets and so forth as he went into Pennsylvania and further north where blacks had the opportunity to have education and so forth. He was going, I'm just absolutely amazed that they do have this capacity.
Isn't it true too? He could have cared less whether slavery ended or continued as long as it helped his purpose of what he was trying to accomplish. Either way.
Who?
Continue or not continue.
Who, Jefferson?
No, Lincoln.
Oh, so Lincoln, you're correct. He did not care about slavery. What he cared about was failure.
Right.
So Lincoln had 18 significant failures throughout his career in life. I think he joined the army as a captain, and he was kicked out as a private. And so there were all of these things that everything he endeavored, he just failed. And I don't know the full history. There's people out there, because I don't care to spend that much time on this. I've come to the conclusion that what's more important, the things we need to focus on, metaphorically speaking, we have to understand how to open this door to get people to actually start exiting this process by using a constitutional process. In other words, going through the right door to actually take us from this illegitimate, you know, layers on top of our legitimate government and restore our legitimate government. There's a Seinfeld episode that I kind of like using metaphorically. This is where Jerry Seinfeld with his date is trying to get through the door because these murderers are coming. Hurry up, Jerry, get through the door. And when you're all stressed, you're trying to open up the keys and so forth. And just proving the point that when we're focused on who's coming after us, so we're at the end, we wasted a whole segment. But when we're focused on the problem coming at us, we can't get through the door. So don't worry about the problem. Let's focus on the solution. Let's focus on the door so that we can actually fight and overcome. We'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the point of all of the first segment was we really need to be focused on getting together, petitioning our government, and taking back our representation. The bottom line is that we have a republican form of government that is demanded by the legitimate supreme law of the land. They, our representatives are supposed to, by the supreme law of the land, because, and welcome back, Tammy. Sorry.
Thank you.
So, what I'm trying to convey here is that there's these concerns. I get, you know, caught up in, well, they're not even taking an oath to the Constitution. The supreme law of the land requires that all public servants take an oath to support this. The language is very clear. This Constitution, in other words, they're being very specific. And I don't think that they knew back then why that word this was going to be so important.
Right, not the annotated one.
Because they had no idea that they would actually create these parallel constitutions or these different versions of the Constitution, all unconstitutionally done. But the original language is this Constitution, that they're required to take an oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. So if they're taking an oath to support a different Constitution, and they don't even understand that, then, you know, do you hold that when if you take a person and you raise them with all bad information to teach them to do things, and, you know, Moses might be a very good example of this. Because when you look at Moses, Moses was brought up as an Egyptian. He really believed that he was a part of this hereditary line of the nobility of Egypt. And he was acting as, you know, what, as actually the Pharaoh's right-hand man. And his cousin or whatever who became Pharaoh, you know, they grew up together. They had this close relationship. Now, my point is that look at here was Moses that had no clue that he was even a part of Israel, and he was living this life and he doing everything that he thought was right until all of a sudden he, you know, came to the knowledge that he was, you know, not Egyptian.
Yeah.
In that allegory, or when you look at, you know, these people today, they have no idea. Was Moses at fault when he ordered Israelites to be killed because they were crossing the line or what have you? No, I mean, bottom line, he was a byproduct of how he was indoctrinated and prepared to do everything that he was doing. And it's the same thing with these people that are getting elected. They don't know.
Yeah.
They have no idea. So they're just, and this is how corrupt the system has gotten, to where it's just self-perpetuating. It's the self-licking ice cream cone that is growing this illegitimacy. So getting people to understand and teaching them that, you know, we need county commissioners to actually demand that they actually are taking an oath to support the organic constitution, what people call the organic, the original, whatever name you want to call it, folks. And, you know, we haven't actually created those standards because why? We're not even united enough to have those types of academic conversations. This is another, you know, growing problem that I have. That, you know, we can't get leaders of all these different organizations to actually, you know, come to the table, because the reason why we probably can't get the Convention of States, the John Birch Societies, and all these other organizations to come to the table is because they are actually a part of the controlled opposition, because there's no way they're going to actually be honest and realize that what they're doing is wrong. They want to continue having people be misled, but that doesn't mean that all the John Birch Society is bad people. There's lots of really good people that have no idea that their leadership is set on not fixing the problem. The same thing with the Convention of States. There's really good people out there, folks. If you're a part of that and I'm offending you, I'm not offending you. I'm offending those who are knowingly doing these deeds, because one of the things the framers did, when you really look at when Britain, actually the king, started reaching in and doing things, it came over a quick period of time where he actually dismissed all the government. And he basically instituted his own governments here in America. And in so doing, it was a real wake-up call, because here in America, it's been really gradual. And all of these, I'll just call them these entities of resistance, John Birch's and so forth, they all started with great intent, but they got co-opted. I don't think that there's an organization out there that isn't either in the process of being co-opted or is co-opted. We know the parties were co-opted a long, long time ago. The only unique party that I know of is the Wyoming Republican Party. And I'm going to tell you that there's no doubt in my mind that Frank E. Thorne and members of the Republican Party are constantly being hit and barraged with bad players that are trying to co-opt them and making sure that they don't really become a part of the solution.
Absolutely.
Satan is doing everything he can to keep us from actually walking in the door of a united meeting, to where we actually put everything on the table and say, what is our path forward that will take back our legitimate government or restore our legitimate government?
And that's the reason why the rhinos in the Wyoming legislature hate the Wyoming Republican Party.
Yes, absolutely. Well, correct. Because this is, folks, if you go to the Wyoming Republican Party, there's these little, you know, titles at the top. You click on About. You click on that About page, and it actually has little two sub pages. One sub page is Republic Review. Now, the fact that it still has that up there means to say that they have not abandoned their position in trying to restore the Constitution and our constitutional government. The day that goes away is the day I say that they've been co-opted, because they're not making any money from that. Their bottom line, they're saying that we support restoring our constitutional government and the process of Republic Review. Now, when that, like I said, when that actually goes away, it'll probably be when Frank E. Thorne, you know, somehow they discredit him enough to where people don't elect him, because that's all it takes is creating these questions, ad hominem attacks. This guy's a bad guy, you know, and they create rumors or what have you. And I know this guy has suffered a lot.
Well, yeah, they've done a pretty successful job. Fortunately, the majority of our state committee knows him on a personal level, and we know that that's not who he is.
Right. So, and one of the things I tell people, because when somebody wants to come along and start attacking in my ear somebody else with rumor, and I don't even care if they want to provide evidence, the question is, the reality is, we're all imperfect. We all have our problems. Are we really going to start using scorched earth? Because that's what Satan wants us. That's another way Satan has divided the conservatives. Oh, well, this person isn't as good as they should be.
Yeah.
If perfection is required for us to walk through that door and work together and unite on the Constitution, then nobody can get into that room. And what
it's absolutely true. So I think having the vice chair, David Holland, has been very beneficial because he's understood that concept that nobody is perfect. So
right. And the question is, do the mistakes in a person's life, you know, do those things actually disqualify that person to be able to participate in this type of activity?
Yeah, absolutely not.
Right. I mean, it's one thing if a guy has a real bad temper and, you know, he has this bias or what have you, or just a bad temper, and he loses his temper and, you know, uses corporal punishment too quickly with his kids. In other words, people label him as a child abuser. Okay, well, you may not want to use him as a babysitter, but that doesn't mean he can't be an effective leader in uniting on the Constitution.
Right.
Do you see my point?
No, I mean, he's been an amazing chair, and I don't know what his plans are for the future, but let's hope he continues.
And you know what? So bottom line, because I don't want to make this show, you know, anti-Frank, I absolutely have the greatest respect for the man. And the fact that he has, you know, been able to use discernment and deductive reasoning. And, you know, I think he's been the best thing for the Wyoming party and for the Wyoming government.
He absolutely has. Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, getting back to focusing on the content, focusing on the Constitution, because if we start understanding this, then we're actually making leaps forward. So let's get back to the powers, because I kind of started, this is where they were enumerating them. And right here, we've kind of left off with calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Now, one of the things that I was basically, because we were talking about mercenary forces, the state police, city police, and so forth. When we look at, when we hire a police force that is going to actually enforce the laws, then what we've done is we've created an entity that does not like the idea that the people they're policing have the ability and the rights to carry guns. Because bad guys carry guns too, and they want to disarm everybody so that they can do their job. They don't want to get shot at. And when we look at the militia and everybody else, why aren't you becoming a part of it? We've created kind of this nation of cowards because nobody wants to stand up and take a fist to the face or throw a punch because they're just afraid to get hurt.
Yeah.
And so we look at these first responders and we glorify them because they're people that are putting the uniform on because, you know, they want to be our protector. And that's great. But we're supposed to be protecting ourselves. The concept of the militia is that we, the people, we're supposed to know the laws to execute them, because that's what it says here, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws. Well, guess what? How can you execute a law if you don't know what it is and how it's to be followed? Laws. Yeah. It says laws, right? So we all have to understand what the laws are. Well, that's shoot. Who has time for that? You know what? These kids in school, they need to be learning. They need to learn the law. They need to understand and appreciate that. I'll tell you one thing. If there's anything, any good application of the brick and mortar school, it would be in training the militia. Bottom line, the states have this responsibility to make sure that every citizen in that state, as these children are being born, are being prepared to actually do their civil duty in executing the laws, suppressing insurrection, repelling invasions. This is everybody's requirement. Now, there are the regular forces. This is why you know, what does it take to get back there? Because people ask these kind of questions. How do we solve this? How do we get back to having a true militia? Well, everybody first has to understand that they're a part of it, that you can't get out of it, and that, you know, when it really push comes to shove, and we're really in the throes of an insurrection, or I should say a real military invasion and a takeover, that only those patriots left have to stand up. You're going to have to pick up that gun. Do you really want to avoid the training or what have you? Or are you really that, are you that much of a coward that you're ready to surrender quickly? Some people would say, well, the French in America would probably do that because they're known for surrendering quickly. And I'm just trying to be funny. Anyway, the point here is the next line. Because what is the next line? It says what?
We're on 15, right?
We're on 15, correct.
Okay. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia.
Stop. Okay. Right. Okay, so what did you just say? So Congress has the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. Now, disciplining, most people think, you know, okay, you know, that's wrong, and we're going to spank you. No. Disciplining means creating the standards, you know, in other words, the guns that we're going to use for handguns are going to be 9mm Glocks, and the rifles we're going to use are going to be AR-15s or whatever the new superior rifle that they want. Because what they want to do is they don't want to have everybody bring their own gun because they have to have bullets for everybody.
I would also think that it would include educating them on the law.
Oh, absolutely. So that is the providing for organizing, arming, and disciplining, because the disciplining is actually teaching them those things. They need to understand the law. They need to have standards. They need to know how to interface. When all of a sudden you get two militias together from two different states, that, you know, everything has to be cohesive. So that they're all receiving these same standards and same training. They have the same kind of weapons so that they can do their job more efficiently. This was one of the things that frustrated Washington, because there wasn't these standards and they weren't actually executing the laws, or I should say they weren't executing by calling forth. Okay, so here's one of the problems, and this is one of the things the military has realized, is that you have to have exercises. You literally have to call forth the militia on a regular basis so that they can, you know, test and train based on, you know, the world threats. Are we prepared to, you know, protect the motherland here? And also providing a supplementation for the Marine Corps and the Navy, as they're actually out as the leading force, the tip of the spear in protecting America and protecting our interests abroad. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So when we kind of look at how the militia literally should be a real central part of everybody's life, it doesn't mean how central is food in your life? How central is food in your life?
I mean, it's
a daily thing, right?
Yeah. It's,
okay. It's how about sleep? Is sleep central in your life?
I'd say it is. Yeah.
Water. Water is another central necessity, right? Law and order and being in a civil government, understanding law and order is essential.
Yeah.
Does it mean that it has to, you know, so let's go back to these other necessities, these fundamentals of life. If food is so central, because there are some people, I guess, that just they focus so much on food that it becomes every facet of their life. And, you know, anybody that, you know, basically immerses themselves completely in the myopic type of thing like food or sleeping, they, you know, it has an effect. And the consequences of, you know, total immersion into something means that everything else is, you know, not important. And all those things are just kind of fall off the plate. Your family, you know, somebody that gets so focused in, you know, in gambling. Gambling is a very addictive thing, and people that get so focused on that, it destroys their family. So we have to look at, one, a balance of life, but we have to look pragmatically to say, if we're going to have a civil society, everybody has to know and understand that they're going to have a part. They have to have a part in this. They have to understand the law, and they actually have to follow the law so that other people don't have to enforce it. Does that make sense? Because
the biggest issue is what law are we studying, and who's the one teaching it?
Yes. So, and this is the other thing, because I mentioned this with Paul, because there's this little phrase that I learned from my father. There's two sides of the law. There's the letter of the law, and there's spirit of the law. And when we look at traffic law, what is the spirit of traffic law? It is to create laws that make an environment that is the safest and conducive for people to travel at the best efficiency for the best productivity so that they can function in their lives, right? I mean, that's the whole spirit of the law. The letter of the law is, you can't exceed the speed limit. Then all of a sudden, when they create those letters, then because government has learned that if we kind of create and, you know, suppress the travel, because people want to go get to work faster, and we're going to make this a crime if you actually travel too fast to work, and because it creates a dangerous condition. Well, you know, what if the roads are wide open? So in other words, if I'm driving 140 miles an hour from, you know, my point of origin to my destination to get to work or wherever I need to get, and the roads are wide open and I can make that trip, you know, safely, and, you know, the road conditions, everything else, why would somebody pull me over to give me a ticket other than for revenue purposes?
Yeah.
And so that's what's happened. Our government started learning how to basically regulate us to make money.
Yep.
Now, we need to actually, this is something we need to invoke into state constitutions, because looking at the grand picture, that's why counties matter most. When you start reading that and you start understanding the limitations of we the people, when we create constitutions, we want to make sure that the government we create does not become nefarious, because they become tax happy. They become regulating happy. And so we want to make sure that we give them the charge and the power to do what's essential, but not to actually, you know, weaponize them to rule us. So maybe we actually need to have lines in the Constitution to give them the authority to create the conditions and laws that, you know, are conducive to, one, promote productivity, but to also promote safety, but not for one to compromise the other. To always maintain a balance, you know, in those types of laws and regulations. And that would be really tough to word, and I'm not necessarily going to try to wordsmith it now, but the point is that we need to have this clarity, so when the people start learning and understanding, had we maintained this path of civility and enlightenment to where everybody started receiving more and more education, and everybody started actually becoming more productive and more capable and having positive effects, how is having more people having positive effects on society a bad thing?
Yeah.
So... and that's what enlightenment is, when you actually have everybody that's doing their share and doing, you know, what's needed to be done, and we're not consumed with, you know, becoming the king of all, like a Bill Gates, I want to be richer and richer, and I want more control and more control. We need to start recognizing those people as sociopaths. They may not be killing people as a sociopath, but they're doing things that actually cause that. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, it just makes me chuckle, because all those cartoons where you're like, I want to rule the world. It's like, it's actually kind of true. There are people who want that.
Right. Absolutely. There are. But we have to learn as a society, we have to start elevating the importance of one thing, discipline. And there's that word right there in the 15th subsection, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining. So go ahead and read the next part of this.
Let's see, where was I at? Okay, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress.
Okay, so the last yellow part, we'll get back to that. But bottom line is that they have this power to provide for the disciplining, the arming and organizing, and for governing such part of them as may be employed. So in other words, the federal government has to have this ability to actually, you know, bring them in and manage them. So in other words, they probably need to have, as the War Department, this, you know, this central management, war management capability, people and interfacings and so forth, so that when all of a sudden these men come up this with their arms and everything else, their weaponry and everything else, so all of a sudden they get deployed. To do that, you actually have to have something to interface that with. And so like a higher headquarters and that type of thing. So bottom line, you know, we look at how to do this. The thing that they didn't do was they didn't do that. They didn't do that well, because that's how the militia became, after the War of 1812, the militia became this permanent thing called the cavalry. And the United States Army was being maintained. And technically, when we look at the U.S. territories, should that have been something under the Navy for the Marine Corps? Should the Marine Corps have been the ones out there doing in the territories? Because that wasn't the United States. That was territories. That was a bridge to foreign nations. And so before it becomes a state and it's a sovereign state where they have that control, that's, you know, kind of like, it's not no man's land. The United States have made claim to it and they've created these territories. But to create a standing army to basically police the territories, for the Army to do that, actually, it probably should have been the Marine Corps under the Navy. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because then the Army would have been able to be focused on actually doing these deployments as new states came in and go, okay, if we have to deploy or defend the United States, we're called, you know, we have these exercises of these new states and the existing states so that they learn how to create a very cohesive and very smooth transition for deploying the militia. They needed to do this on a regular basis. That's what the military does on a regular basis every year, multiple times a year. Military forces, Marines, Army, and Air Force, all of them have these exercises. They actually, you know, go and play war. We kind of have to do that. So when we look at the militia, this is going to be a body of people that will be doing this permanently. But we also have to understand that every other person needs to be rotated into this. One, you have to at least appreciate what these people do. And plus, it actually helps share the load so that not one person is always stressed and one person is actually going down this path of, you know, being the one that's sacrificing to travel and be deployed and so forth. Families in those days actually had their own careers. They had their own farms. They did things. And so you had to have a balance between being a part of the militia and being able to provide for your family. And the best way to do that is to create a system that actually shares that responsibility. And if you really think about it, this goes back to what I'm saying. We have this thing called civility that was baked into this Constitution, that if everybody was doing their share, we'll come back and finish this, but if everybody's doing their share of carrying the load, then nobody really has to suffer and nobody has to become overcome by the system itself. Anyway, we'll get back into this militia and its importance tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.